This is our Guiyet reading group. We are continuing our reading of Cybernetics and the Origin of Information. This time I remembered the title. We're still on chapter one. We're picking up at page 24 of the translation. So far, he's been sort of giving like a very quick overview of the like mode of functioning of certain types of, you know, what he's calling information machines, primarily, I guess, computers. You know, obviously he's writing in the 50s, so these are, you know, extremely primitive computers by contemporary standards. But the basic sort of architecture of these devices is the same as what we have now. We just have, you know, much more complicated and sophisticated versions of the same types of devices as he was describing. So of course there's the binary arithmetic, so, you know, representing numbers in terms of one and zero, instead of in our decimal system we have the 0 to 9 digits, and then translating logical operations, so like operations that have to do with the truth value of propositions, in terms of this Boolean algebra that can also be manipulated in terms of binary arithmetic. So you just represent a true proposition by one and a false proposition by zero, and then you can set up these rules for manipulating these propositions that are completely independent of the actual content of those propositions or the semantics of those propositions. So any true proposition can just be represented by a one, no matter how, you know, trivial or significant, or, you know, what domain that proposition is talking about, etc. They're all just reduced to this truth value representation of a one or a zero. And then you can use these representations of the truth values to sort of build up to calculate the truth value of a complex proposition, so one that contains other simpler propositions as you know, constituents. You can calculate the truth value of the complex proposition based on the structure of that proposition and the truth values of the constituent propositions. So like the simplest ones would be like using the AND connective. So if you have A and B for some propositions A and B, and you know the truth values of A and of B, then you can calculate what is the truth value of the complex proposition A and B. So in this case, A and B is true if and only if both A and B are true. And you can, you know, develop other connectives like OR, XOR, the exclusive OR, et cetera. If then all these different sort of connectives that can be implemented in physical circuits, so that you have, you know, you can represent one and zero by you know, high and low voltage, and you can set up physical circuits that will, you know, add or combine the incoming voltages of two inputs in a way that implements the type of logical operation you want to perform. So yeah, the whole, like, all these sort of what we would think of as intellectual operations of performing inferences, for example, of, you know, saying that this proposition follow from this other proposition, can actually be like fully abstracted from any understanding of the meaning of these propositions and just, you know, translate them into this extremely simplistic form of ones and zeros, and then combining those simple propositions into complex propositions and implementing those combinations in terms of physical circuits. So this is sort of the basic, I don't know, principle or procedure for developing a computing device. And, you know, our, you know, laptops and phones and so on are essentially just this type of thing repeated many millions of times and operating very quickly. And I think the reason why he wants to sort of emphasize this and go through the sort of procedure for implementing this is that it, you know, when we have something like a laptop that can, you know, play videos, play music, you know, run games and so on, it can do all sorts of different operations. We of course don't see the individual, flipping of circuits and, you know, adding the voltages together or combining voltages and so on. And there's a sort of maybe illusion that this is sort of that operating in this sort of seamless way that is in some sense analogous to what happens when we are thinking or, you know, imagining a scene happening or something like that. But in at the sort of underlying level, the physical implementation of these circuits is extremely simplistic, and Rieh wants to emphasize that the computer, no matter how complicated it is, there's nowhere in that whole operation where the computer actually understands anything that's happening. It's all just, you know, the flow of electrical currents across different circuits that is arranged in such a way that it produces a result that we as humans looking at the screen, for example, can view as a movie or can hear as a song or whatever. But there's nowhere in the computer that like sort of understands the song, that grasps the song. And if we go back to what we talked about in the Merleau-Ponty reading, like this sort of melodic grasp or this grasp of a melody, there's nothing in the computer that resembles that. It's just one bit, you know, passing through this processing system, and then the next bit, and so on. It's just sort of going through this mechanical procedure. I think he wants to sort of emphasize that aspect of like this very mechanical operation that has no place for understanding at any point in the process, and sort of making sure that we don't forget that, because as you sort of combine these operations and into, you know, many thousands of operations being performed per second, it sort of produces this illusion of like this sort of understanding, maybe, or like it seems as if the computer understands music or understands a scene being represented or something like that. At the more fundamental level, it's really just ones and zeros being moved around in certain ways. One thing before we sort of dive into the reading for today, I wanted to come back to something that we talked about, I think the last couple sessions, which is this sort of thought experiment that Rieh proposes of sort of picturing, you know, an automatic production of a radio program and then an automatic, you know, listener to the radio program that would, you know, send comments about the radio program back to the, you know, generator of that program, and then, you know, have those comments be, you know, evaluated and incorporated into the future selection of or you know, production of that radio program. And so we talked about how in terms of technological realizability, this is probably feasible to set up now. If you thought this was like a worthwhile use of your time, you could, you know, set up a Spotify algorithm that would, you know, select music. You could even have like, you know, a ChatGPT or other Gen AI system, you know, write a little script for like, you know, the intro, like to different pieces of music. And then have like a voice synthesis that would, you know, produce the voice of the host of the radio program, and you could even like have interviews with a guest written by Gen AI and so on, and then you could have another AI system that would, you know, listen to the sound and use that to like generate comments about like this is interesting or boring or you know, I want you to play more of this type of music or whatever. And then send those comments back to the first system and have the system, you know, take those comments in and use it to change how it produces the next, you know, iteration. You could set something like that up. I think it would be technically feasible. But we talked about how, like, you can just sort of intuitively see that this would be a completely pointless operation. It would just be like a waste of electricity and, you know, time set up in you know, used to program this whole system, because it's just sort of circulating automatically, and there's no, like, at no point in this whole operation is anyone actually like enjoying or bored by or, you know, interested in any of these operations. It's all just, again, just all ones and zeros at the root of it, just moving around in different ways. And I was thinking about this sort of thought experiment, and it seems like part of why we like grasped immediately that this is a completely pointless operation has to do with the sort of specialization of these systems, that like you have one system that only generates radio shows and then another system that only listens to radio shows and sends comments. And this is part of why the whole procedure seems pointless, I think. But if you think of like, maybe the first system doesn't just generate radio shows, but it also generates, say, recipes or restaurant reviews or book reviews or like whatever it does. It writes a novel. It can tell you how to cook dinner. It does like a wide variety of things. And then the other one can read a novel and say this is good or bad. I don't know, maybe you can give it a sensor that you can shove food into it, and then it will like analyze it and say this is a good meal or a bad meal or whatever. So if you imagine that these systems are not just specialized in this pointless circulation of, producing a radio show and then evaluating it, but have like a much wider variety of ways of taking in information about the world and producing some sort of output, I think it's maybe less obvious that the whole thing is pointless if you imagine that these systems are much more sort of general and wide-ranging compared to the much more specialized one that Rie presents. I'm wondering what everyone thinks about that. Is there still sort of a qualitative difference between the human case where you have a human radio host and a human listener interacting, or is it more, I guess, the question of degree, where humans of course are capable of not just producing and listening to radio shows, but all sorts of other kinds of production and criticism tasks.
I wonder if that would get around his objection about the perpetual energy machine or perpetual information machine. Professional motion machine of the third kind, I think is what he calls it. Even if there were these more generalized mechanical productions and responses, if ultimately, it was just, if they were just sort of synthesizing massive amounts of training set data, but not genuinely inventing or producing new information in the sense in which Rie has been talking about, then it seems like it would run into the same problem and would just kind of like inevitably degrade, even if they were doing multiple kind of operating in multiple domains.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. So for people listening, so this perpetual motion objection that Rie raised in the introduction has to do with how all of these information operations, like these Boolean algebra, operations on logical propositions, for example, they can only ever transmit at most the content of information that they receive. And then, of course, in practice, in any actually physically implemented sort of information operation, whether it's a digital computer or some sort of analog transmission, there's always a certain amount of noise. So the information content that you receive is always less by some degree than the information transmitted. But then the question, the question is like, if you can only ever transmit less than or maximum the same amount of information as you have at the outset, then it would seem that the content of information that is circulating in the world or that is going around in these networks or whatever would constantly be declining. There would be less and less information available. This example of the radio show, the automatic radio show generator, and then the automatic letter to the editor generator, he describes it as a kind of perpetual motion machine of information, in the sense that if you had a system like this that would just keep circulating, it would be analogous to a machine that you could power on its own outputs, for example, that would just keep running forever. Whereas we know, of course, in like a thermodynamic machine, a steam engine or whatever, it constantly loses a certain amount of usable energy in the form of heat. So you can't have a perpetual motion machine in like a thermodynamic sense. It seems like if any information operation only at best preserves the amount of information and more often loses a certain amount of information, then likewise it would be impossible to have a perpetual motion of information. So then the question, I guess, the question that comes up is one that we had talked about in relation to Simon Don, which is like, where does the information come from in the first place that you want to transmit? For Rie, it's going to be, the answer is going to be that there's this sort of qualitative difference between this mechanical procedure that computers follow And then what living beings are capable of, this what he calls this oversight, or actually, I'm not sure what the translation is in English. I don't think we've seen that term yet, but in French, it's survol, like hovering over or something like that, that you can not only sort of proceed from one step to the next following a rule, but you can also sort of grasp the whole like sequence and decide, you know, is this rule something I want to follow or not? Or is it, should I, you know, change the rule or select a different rule or whatever? So yeah, for Grier, he's going to insist that there's this qualitative difference. One thing that I, maybe it's sort of an objection to that, is that we have the sense, of course, that these machines are like specialized, that they're only capable of performing a certain restricted set of tasks. And then you can even if you imagine that there's more generalized than just producing a radio show and just, you know, listening to the radio show and giving comments, you know, something like ChatGPT is more generalized. You can, you know, ask it to write a poem or to summarize an article or whatever. But it's still, you know, relatively limited in the types of things. Like, it still only takes in text and produces text or you know, does a fairly limited set of tasks compared to what a human can do. And we think of human cognitive capabilities as open-ended in the sense that there's no sort of intrinsic limit that says you can only, like, a human can only take in text and output text. But we know that's not true. But of course, the sort of, I guess, paradox behind that is that if there were some sort of domain that humans were incapable of, you know, operating in terms of cognitive operations, then by definition, we wouldn't be able to know that there was such a domain, right? Whatever limits there are to human cognitive abilities, we would never be able to cognize those domains just by definition. So it could be, you know, it doesn't seem to be a way we can, you know, demonstrate that humans actually are open-ended in that sense. It could still be the case that humans are, you know, have much more flexibility and are capable of acting in many more cognitive domains than ChatGPT is, but still a finite number or a finite sort of sphere of operations. And that it's really just a sort of quantitative difference that, you know, ChatGPT or these similar systems has like a much more restricted domain compared to humans, but it's still just a question of degree. And yeah, so I don't know if Huiye has a good answer to that question of like, or that objection, I guess, that's saying that humans are really just sort of a more flexible, more sophisticated, you know, type of information machine compared to the, you know, extremely simplistic information machines that our computers implement.
I wonder if like, as you mentioned, it seems like Grier would say that there's a qualitative difference in, you know, when there is something like survol. My understanding is that Grier thinks that even like relatively simple natural processes, like my understanding is that he's kind of a panpsychist, and that survol exists, well, at the very least for very simple forms of life. I think for me that would be the maybe the key distinction between like even if there was a very complex machine that could kind of participate in every single imaginable human cultural activity, if it didn't have like a grasp of the whole of, you know, the melody or meaning or sense of what it's doing, then it would seem to me that it's just, you know, like a factory that's running, but, you know, no, kind of nobody's there, you know? And then on the other hand, even if the process that it carried out was very simple, if it somehow had a grasp of the meaning of the process, I think that would be a different situation. So yeah, my understanding would be less about like the number of domains in which it can operate than kind of the quality of its operation in those domains.
Yeah, so I think Huiye doesn't really get into it, I think, in this book, but some of his other books, you know, he has the term psychobiology, that he thinks that like embryology, for example, or developmental biology is characterized by the same kind of, you know, survol or grasp of this rule as such, or this, you know, principle as such, as in, you know, human goal-directed action. Yeah, so that there's something quasi-teleological, even if it's not. So obviously the, you know, the acorn doesn't sort of have a picture of a tree, of an oak tree, you know, sort of in its head. It doesn't even have a head, of course. It's not like sort of, you know, thinking, oh, I'm going to become an oak tree. But there's something, you know, analogous to a human goal-directed action in the way that an acorn becomes an oak tree, or the way that, you know, an egg becomes a chicken or whatever. Yeah, and I mean, that's a whole, like, other domain of questions about, you know, teleology in biology, for example, that are, you know, is also quite complicated and, you know, still debated among philosophers of biology today. But I think, yeah, coming back to the, like, specifics of this case, like what you were describing about the, if you imagine, yeah, some, you know, android robot that, you know, sort of was indistinguishable in behavior from, you know, a living human being, that, you know, you could talk to it, it could, you know, read a novel and say whether it, you know, enjoyed it or not, and, you know, listen to music, et cetera, all the different things that we, you know, expect humans to be able to do. If, you know, if you suppose that there is such a thing, I guess the question is whether we want to suppose that there is, like, sort of this, whether it's possible. I mean, this is in philosophy of mind, the whole, like, zombie question, like, is it conceivable that there could be, yeah, exactly. is it conceivable that this being could, you know, be indistinguishable in terms of its behavior from a human, but still not be, but still have this sort of qualitative difference from a human in the sense that it really is just operating in this mechanical way and doesn't have this survol or this grasp, this melodic grasp that humans have. Yeah, I don't know if there's, like, a good argument one way or the other for this, like, to be able to say that, yes, this is something that makes sense, or no, it doesn't. But yeah, I think it's an interesting question to sort of, like, try to, yeah, I guess, see what the consequences are of assuming that there is or is not, you know, this possibility of, like, a, yeah, this zombie, as it's talked about in philosophy of mind, that, like, I mean, I think the yes or no question, whether this exists or not, or is conceivable or not, is not that interesting. But, like, the more interesting question is what consequences follow from assuming that it is or is not conceivable, in terms of, yeah, whether this, like, melodic grasp is qualitatively distinct from this, I guess, mechanical operation that computers perform. And I think maybe that this is also, I mean, sorry, we haven't really gotten into the text at all yet, but I think this is also maybe a more interesting way of approaching the question than, like, I think in most sort of analytic philosophy of mind, like, I mean, I have a lot of sort of skepticism towards the concept of consciousness, and a lot of it has in like analytic philosophy of mind has to do with, like, the notion of qualia, like, is there something it is like to experience something, you know, the experience of red or whatever, that, yeah, what is it like to be a bat? Yes, thanks, Beth. You can enlighten us on that subject later on. I think this sort of focus on, like, qualia seems pretty, seems like a false problem to me. But I think raising it or framing the problem in terms of this, like, melodic grasp and whether it is distinct in nature from, like, a mechanical operation seems like a better sort of framing of the problem than, yeah, this, like, is there, like, a little light on inside the head of this being that it resembles a human in its outward behavior. Okay, so that was a bit of a digression, or, yeah, sort of more discussion of some of the ideas than, like, looking at the text itself, but we can, yeah, dive into the text where we were. So, again, that's page 24 at the heading Inducing Machines. If someone could read the first page or so from there.
I can read. Inducing Machines. Inducing machines are still largely at the early stage of planning. This is unfortunate because induction, unlike deduction, seems to be an enriching operation as far as information is concerned, and therefore very closely concerns the problem of its origin. As cyberneticians work relentlessly on the problem of learning, which, as we will see, involves a certain statistical induction, we can imagine that machines that can draw general laws from statistical data will soon appear. Already in 1925, the American behaviorist C.L. Hull invented a machine for making correlation calculations. This is a matter of calculation and therefore nothing extraordinary for a machine to be able to do. But on the other hand, a calculation of correlation is very close to an induction. Do tall men also have a wide arm span? To answer this question, you need to take a tape measure and measure the height and arm span of a large number of subjects. By comparing the scores of the subjects and applying the well-known formulas, we find that the correlation is positive 0.82. The machine can do the calculation when given the results, which is comparable to the extraction of a general law from particular data, while also accompanying the law with a quantitative degree of probability. Provided it is given sufficient data, the same kind of machine could theoretically answer the question, quote, do animals without bile live longer than others, unquote, or, quote, are blonde men with blue eyes more enterprising than others, unquote, or are short and fat men more prone to cyclothemia, unquote. Another operation very similar to induction is interpolation or extrapolation, and several logicians have reduced induction to interpolation. A machine can easily interpolate and extrapolate. Interpolation between two numbers in a table is one of the common operations of electronic calculation machines. The simplest possible example of an interpolation, quote-unquote, machine is provided by an ordinary ruler, with the help of which a straight line is drawn or extended from two given points. Other examples that are almost as simple are a compass, a reduction compass, a curvograph, and a drafting pencil. A machine using these simple instruments may be able to extend a series of numbers obeying a rule, or to fill a gap in the series. And there are two series of numbers, one which is increasing by two, and one which is decreasing by like n minus one, I think. It can automatically indicate the rule of the series. It can also correct a quote-unquote false number in a series of numbers. A quote-unquote false number in the series of 4, 11, 13, 19, 20, 19, 16, or 0, 0, 5, 9, 12, 14, 15, 14 is not obvious. But a machine that could translate them into graphs and could detect anomalies in the curves by pressure on a membrane could easily detect it. However, all these operations are considered to be intelligent operations, requiring a certain amount of inventive effort, as they're classical tests of intellectual level. Machines are capable of a host of, quote, eductions of relation, unquote, from given correlates, or, quote, eductions of correlates, unquote, according to a given relation, to use Spearman's vocabulary. These constitute actions that Spearman considers to be typical of intelligence and as, quote, unquote, noogenetic, that is, as involving the creation of knowledge. Spearman gives as an example of an, quote, education of correlates, unquote, the task of finishing a figure according to a model of different proportions, figure 1.1. It is possible to conceive of an amplifying machine that would not only reproduce the AB part of a diagram shown below by enlarging it, but which, conversely, when the path A prime, B prime is imposed on it, would recognize the degree of amplification by a kind of automatic learning and would continue the curve according to this degree until C prime is reached. By combining the optician's devices to measure the number of diopters of a spectacle lens, the lens cutting device, we would have an quote unquote intelligent machine, at least if we take Spearman's definition literally. An interpolating machine could have aided Kepler and even in principle could have replaced him in the task of deriving the laws governing planetary trajectories from Tycho Brahe's observations. Today, in fact, radars with automatic computers detect the trajectory of large caliber mortar shells and determine their point of origin by extrapolation. Maybe I'll just read the next short paragraphs because I think they kind of finished this thought. Completing or restoring information is an operation very similar to, almost indistinguishable from, the creation of information or invention. Any invention, even the most seemingly spontaneous, can be considered as a recovery of information. When psychologists have tried to discover the origin of invention, they have in fact used tests to restore incomplete or confused information. sentences or words to be completed, series of drawings to be put in order, and so forth. In science or technology as well, invention is almost always a completion or restoration of information. Cyberneticians may have some hope of making inventing machines. Moreover, it is not improbable that the inventor's brain often works like an interpolating machine. That is, through harmonious completion, the rounding of data, and the dynamic search for simplicity, symmetry, and equilibrium. On this point, as on many others, cybernetics can have recourse to that more subtle behaviorism that is Gestalt theory. We know that for this theory, intelligent invention represents neither a transcendent action nor a process of pure trial and error without direction, but a spontaneous reorganization of the perceptual field, isomorphic to the cortical dynamic field. This reorganization is carried out according to the principle of least action or of least tension. Yeah, so I guess the basic idea here seems to be that there are interpolating and induction machines, and that if we understand interpolation to be completing or restoring information, which seems to be something that machines can do, then I guess the question is whether that constitutes invention. And then he seems to be saying in this last paragraph that since this completion happens by this kind of dynamic search for equilibrium, maybe Gestalt theory can be used to provide a kind of theoretical justification for this mechanical mechanistic understanding of invention. If it's just the discovery of a good form in the perceptual field and isomorphically in the brain.
Yeah. So again, these like very simple machines, or you know, slightly more sophisticated than just, you know, adding a one and a zero, but it's still a completely mechanical operation to take in, you know, the heights and arm spans of different people and calculate the extent to which there's a correlation between them. This is something you can do. I think you can do this in Excel now. It's very, very simple. And this is in some sense analogous to, you know, human learning, that, you know, you see a bunch of people that are tall and short, and then you see whether they have long arms or not, and you sort of come up with a general idea that taller people have longer arms. It's not like a much of a scientific discovery, but it is to some extent a kind of learning. And then you can also, on the basis of this learning, you can sort of extrapolate that, you know, you observe someone who is tall, but you don't see their arm span, but then you sort of suppose, you extrapolate from the data that you already have, you suppose that this person will also have long arms. And you know, more often than not, you'll be right. And you know, maybe more like, this is obviously a very simplistic example, but like in a maybe more slightly more realistic example, you can have like, you know, the child you know, experiences, has contact with certain dogs and observes that the dogs that they have contact with bark, and then in a later encounter with a dog, the child will assume that this new dog will also bark. So it's, you know, the child has learned this correlation between like dog shape, creature, and barking sound, and then will extrapolate from this to suppose that this other dog shaped creature will also bark. And, you know, Huye doesn't deny that a lot of human learning is like this, that we just sort of, you know, develop these sort of inductive laws by, you know, taking in data and then, you know, performing something analogous to this calculation of like correlations and so on. And then we can extrapolate, you know, on the basis of our inductive analysis of our experiences, and then, you know, come up with predictions for new situations. So yeah, he's not denying that this does happen, that you know, human learning is like this in certain domains or in certain respects, but he wants to, I guess, make us like skeptical that this is like the only thing that is involved in human learning. And especially when we learn something that when we learn something new in the sense that like of invention, that, you know, when Kepler, for example, is doing astronomy, he's not just sort of extracting a pattern from data in the way that a machine learning system today would be able to do. He's also, you know, producing this new conception, this new, I guess, model of the solar system, that this is like an invention in the proper sense. It's the creation of something new rather than just extracting something that was already in the, you know, observational data that he was working on. So again, this is like, I guess it's just partly is just an insistence that there's this qualitative difference between like extracting a pattern from data that, you know, in principle is already in that data, on the one hand, and then inventing something new that allows you to grasp the data in a different way on the other hand. He's just sort of insisting that these are qualitatively different operations. So the cybernetics and the Gestalt psychologists are sort of supposing that there is no qualitative difference here, that they give different models for how this actually happens, but for both like schools of research or schools of thought, the process of inventing a model of the solar system is essentially the same kind of thing as calculating whether tall people have long arm spans. It's the same kind of process, even if one is more complicated than the other. Okay, we can go on to the next bit. 61, are you able to read today? Do you have a mic and everything set up? Okay, yeah, that's fine. No worries. I can read the next bit. It is very interesting to realize that if taken to the logical conclusion of their fundamental hypotheses, cybernetics combined with Gestalt theory again leads to perpetual motion of the third kind. We know that in macroscopic physics, the principle of least action has the closest relation to the principle of evolution toward maximum entropy. To bring invention, creation, or the restoration of information back to the principle of least action is in fact to bring information back to what, according to cybernetics itself, is precisely its opposite, entropy. It is the increase in entropy, the march towards symmetry, rounding, and equilibrium, that would ultimately explain the increase in information, whereas information is entropy with the opposite sign. The contradiction is obvious. Moreover, experience shows that in the history of ideas, the, quote, economy of thought, unquote, as Ernst Mach used to say, anticipating Gestalt theory, the search for a harmonious, well-rounded theory leads much more often to an unfortunate stop than to progress. Information and theories that are too, quote, unquote, beautiful, too simple, are almost always false. As per invention itself, for example, in the order of technology, it is all too paradoxical to interpret the ever-increasing complexity of industrial devices as a march toward, quote-unquote, good forms. For a machine or an organism to improve almost always means for it to become more complex. What can be misleading, however, is that after inventing a new, more sophisticated and complex device, the inventor, and this is part of the engineer's intellectual reflexes, seeks to eliminate unnecessary complexities. This can be done by making a single mechanism useful for two purposes if they are needed. In cars today, the horn control is mounted on the same lever as the lighting control. Just as in vertebrate organisms, the genito-urinary system is mixed. Successful machines, like successful organisms, have a simplified, rounded, smooth external appearance without add-ons. Modern airplanes, which are so complex, seem simpler to the eye than the old biplanes of Farman's time. A dolphin seems simpler than a sea cucumber, which is in reality more rudimentary. Economy in invention, far from being its very essence, is only a last and late improvement. We can therefore suspect that if an interpolating or inducing machine seems to imitate certain intelligent acts according to Spearman's definition, it is not because the machine is intelligent, it is because the definition is poor. Spearman is the opposite of a mechanist in psychology, and he understands that quote-unquote noogenesis transcends the plane of mechanical functioning. But he is wrong not to distinguish sufficiently in his definition between what is an understanding of the meaning of a relation and what is imitable and feasible as a rule inscribed in a machine. The test of completing words in a sentence only seems to resemble number completion or the extension of a curve. The machine for detecting errors or pseudo-errors in a digital series is in reality only a machine for detecting singular points, which may or may not have the character of an error depending on the meaning given to it by a conscious observer. On the contrary, it can be an interesting quote-unquote residue in the sense that logicians of induction understand the word. Moreover, inducing machines can only ever serve as auxiliaries for consciousness. They cannot replace it. When astronomers use a stereoscope with two photographs taken some time apart to detect a small planet that has moved in the stellar field and which consequently seems to come out of the photographs, they are indeed using a semi-mechanical effect, but with a purpose very different than that of the search for an error. A machine that would correct all anomalies would not be a very good machine for discovering or inventing. If instead of Kepler's mind and his trust in Tycho Brahe the observer, a trust stronger than his mythical faith in Pythagoras, we had had a machine to interpolate and regularize the Gestalten, this machine would have had a high risk of converting Chico's data into points on a circle instead of revealing the elliptical form of the trajectories. In order for us to speak of true induction or invention, it is necessary that the mind interprets according to a meaning. We know that one of the serious inconveniences of automatic machines with a, quote, probe head, unquote, for anti-aircraft battle is that they are always susceptible to being mistaken about the identity of their targets and a confusing friend and enemy. Appropriate signals can guide them, but accidents are frequent. The radars that defended Antwerp against low-flying bombs apparently had the tendency to mistake their targets and adjust their aim toward the surrounding church steeples. That sounds like a less than ideal way of guiding anti-aircraft guns. So here, this passage, I think, is very closely connected with some points from Simondon. So this discussion of invention here is, of course, very, quick and not that, developed, but it aligns, I think, pretty well with Simondon's analysis of technical evolution about how, for example, technical objects become more concrete over time, over the development of a technical lineage. We talked about how like a motor to start with might have like a ventilator or like some sort of heat dispersal mechanism, like just sort of added onto it. But then as the motor is developed and becomes more sophisticated, the heat ventilation or like the heat dispersal mechanism is sort of incorporated into the functioning of the motor itself, and there's no like sort of separate element that has this heat dispersal function, but it's the motor design as such that sort of disperses excess heat. And so this is the same type of process as Ruyer is describing here, where the more like sophisticated device sort of combines different functions in one component or one sort of element of that device. And the same thing in evolution of living beings, where you don't have like these sort of separate components that look complicated in like a more superficial view of the organism. Like if you look at a dolphin, for example, the whole body is like streamlined, and so you have like the fins, of course, are like navigation organs, and then the tail is like a propulsion system. But these are all like sort of combined together. They all like form a unified body shape. There's no like propulsion system sort of added on to the back, like in a way that you would like take a speedboat. You just like attach the motor to the hull of the boat, and it's like completely separate from the hull itself. Whereas of course a dolphin is not like that at all. So in one sense, the dolphin seems simpler than the speedboat. Because it's just this sort of single, you can draw like a line, children can draw the shape of a dolphin much more easily than the shape of a speedboat with its motor and everything. This sort of simplification is obviously not the same kind of simplification as, having an input of a bunch of data points and then, calculating the average and, discarding the individual data points taking in all the data points and discarding outliers, for example. The development of this streamlined dolphin body shape is not just a loss of information in the sense that you would like sort of take in the propulsion component and the body shape component and then sort of lose the information contained in each of these components. Like that's not how dolphins evolved, of course. And the whole like development of this dolphin streamlined propulsion, navigation, everything all sort of combined together. In one sense, we can think of this as an invention. Of course, not like an individual dolphin inventing, but like the dolphin lineage has invented this, combined streamlined body plus propulsion plus navigation all together. This seems like a creation of information as opposed to like a loss of information. He's just sort of insisting on the fact that these inventions, to try to explain invention in terms of loss of information, seems pretty paradoxical. And to connect this also with something else that not that we read together here, but in I forget the name of the text, but there's one text where he's talking about he gives a what seems like a very strange definition of empiricism, where he describes empiricism as supposing that the concept is in the object, like sort of before we start thinking about it. But I think you can sort of understand it in terms of this kind of induction machine, in the sense that, you know, it supposes that Kepler's laws of the motion of the planets were already there in this, you know, set of data points that Brahe had gathered, that, you know, all that Kepler's act of, you know, developing his laws of the motion of the planets was essentially just extracting what was already in the data from sort of the superfluous noise. And it, you know, this sort of empiricism in general just take, or like this sort of radically inductive understanding of science or of, you know, knowledge creation, takes it that when we understand something, we are essentially just extracting something that is already there in the object that we're trying to understand from all these other sort of superfluous elements of the object that we discard. And so, yeah, it's the same kind of depiction of this inductive process as what Rie is describing here, that learning about an object consists essentially of forgetting everything except what is important. It, you know, to put it in like a very sort of simple terms, that like you encounter a bunch of individual dogs and you forget everything that's specific about those dogs to extract like the dog concept from that is in each of these dogs, but is hidden by like the different color and size, etc. And that's what learning in general consists in. And if you sort of look, if you try to like apply this picture to the history of science, for example, this is like, you know, not at all how science actually proceeds in real life. Of course, Kepler, you know, studied the data that had been assembled by Brahe, but he didn't like just sort of take it all in and then like calculate, you know, some correlation coefficient or whatever. He was like doing a creative process of coming up with different models. And he actually tried many models before he arrived at the elliptical orbit model. So he's like doing this creative process of producing a model. And so to describe that as like just a process of discarding information is like a complete misconception of what Kepler was doing.
Yeah, I guess this seems... I know you mentioned this earlier, but it seems like he would have gotten along with Simondon if they had talked about this stuff, because in Simondon, you know, the really any kind of individuation involves a genuine creation that resolves some pre-existing tension of some kind that can't be... it's not just the averaging of the components that give rise to the new individual. It's, you know, like binocular vision includes everything in both of the retinal images that it subsumes without reduction. Like it doesn't just select the, you know, the area of vision that would be common to both retinal images. I wonder, I need to go back and reread some Simondon. So I wonder, I know that Simondon is critical of Gestaltism in some places. I'm thinking, for instance, of when he's talking about perception and like the perception of an animal, which has nothing to do with the discovery of a kind of geometric good form. But it is still, you know, a kind of resolution of tension, which could be understood as like, you know, the discovery of a form, just in a less restrictive way, I guess, than the Gestaltists want to understand pregnant forms and perception.
Yeah, and like the example that Rie gives of the astronomical procedure, where to maybe explain a little bit more what he's describing here. So like, there are these devices called stereoscopes, where you essentially show a slightly different image to each eye. It's like a sort of binocular type device that you look into with both eyes, and the difference between the images in each eye sort of reproduces the difference in the retinal image in regular binocular vision. which is part of how we perceive depth, of course. And so you can take like two photographs of you know, a street scene or whatever it is, from a slightly different angle and show the two photographs to each eye. And then it sort of produces an effect of seeing the street scene with depth as opposed to like as a flat image. And you can, and you know, there's been many, like, this was like a sort of a whole field in psychology of like doing studies of like, you know, what degree of separation, angular separation between the two images produces the best like sort of depth perception effect, and like what happens if you sort of make them too separated from each other. If I remember correctly, it turns out that when the images are like too separate from each other to be sort of fused into this depth perception, you end up having like a sort of alternating effect where you see one image and then the other alternately, and you don't ever see like two separate images superimposed on each other, for example. Yeah, so this is like very close to the types of examples that Simon Don talks about of, you know, how depth perception involves not sort of like discarding the differences between the two images to produce like a sort of average of the two images, but instead of using the difference between the two images as the basis for like the production of a new dimension of the scene, of you know, seeing the scene as having depth. And it's the same, this is the same type of argument as what Rie is giving here, where like if you use this astronomical procedure of a stereoscope, so you like look at two images of the same part of the sky taken at slightly different times, like maybe an hour apart or whatever, and then, you know, the most of the stars will be in the same position, but there's one that has moved slightly over the course of the hour, that this one will stand out in the stereoscope as if it's like popping out of, or, you know, depending on the direction, I guess it could be, you know, receding from the plane of the other stars. And this indicates that this is actually a planet that is moving relative to the supposed fixed stars in the background. So just by sort of staring at this planet over the course of an hour, you wouldn't actually see any motion, but by looking at this stereoscopic display, you can like just see the planet sticking out from the plane of the other stars. And of course, if you used like one of these inductive machines to just sort of eliminate outliers, then, or like to produce an average between the two images, you would just like eliminate this planet movement because it's an outlier, and you would lose that, you know, the fact that this is something interesting and that you want to study more. You know, likewise, in the way that Simon Don argues that, you know, depth perception, or, you know, the perception of binocular perception doesn't involve an averaging or an induction from the two images to find what is common to them. It involves actually making use of the difference. And so this is like the same type of criticism of both this sort of simplistic, like associationist or like induction oriented approach to learning. And then also the Gestalt conception, which is like, I think they both see it as like a more sophisticated version of the same type of intellectual framework, because it likewise takes like learning to perceive a face, or, you know, the shape of an animal or whatever it is, as this sort of minimization process that is ultimately of the same nature as, you know, discarding information between the two retinal images to produce an average image. And they see this as like completely contrary to what actually happens in depth perception. Just a note in passing here, there's one bit that we just read where let me just find the page again. The first paragraph on page 25, he quotes Spearman as talking about the education of correlates. The actual term that Spearman uses is eduction. So this is what his sort of like invented word for this, extrapolation from the data that is taken in. So that, yeah, like the way that Kepler, for example, produces his laws of elliptical planetary motion by like analyzing the data, the observational data of the positions of the planets. It should be eduction of correlates, not education, but yeah, it doesn't make a big difference here. 61, are you ready to read now? From Self-Regulating Machines.
Yeah, can you all hear?
Yes. So you can reach the next heading up to feedback and self-regulation. Thanks.
Okay. Self-regulating machines. In self-regulating machines, the information doesn't simply pass from the input to the output of the machine with one-way transformations, as in calculating machines. It is used in a recurrent circuit that goes from the output back to the input in feedback to control the very operation of the machine. Let us first consider the intermediate case of a so-called subservient mechanism. For example, the rudder control wheel of a large ship does not act directly on the rudder. Its movement triggers the operation of servo motors that rotate the rudder until it reaches the desired position. The servo motors then stop automatically. The information given by the helmsman is used by the machine, which is responsible for operating according to the information. The same is true for the control of an elevator. If I press the fifth floor button, I give a certain information to the device, which knows how to use it. Now suppose that the helmsman of the boat is replaced by a gyroscopic heading indicator. The helmsman, or the captain, will only give information in the form of a general ideal. He will not have to read the deviation relative to the fixed heading at each moment. The gyroscope will give all the intermediate and technical information needed to reach the destination. If the boat deviates from its course, it is the gyroscope, or more precisely, a device for reading the difference between the fixed heading and the actual direction of the boat, that will be informed, and that will then inform the servo motors. The self-regulating machine will apparently not only operate, it will also perform actions that are finalized in the etymological sense of the word. Everything will happen as if an ideal end controlled and corrected its operation by self-regulation until it reaches that end. We see that automata of this type do not imitate pure thought, that is, the purely combinatorial aspects of thought. Rather, they imitate what we could call interested consciousness, governed by an instinct or a value, which seeks a reduction of tension between its current state and its ideal state. From this point of view, they do not go at all in the direction of the fantasy of being rational in the pure sense. They imitate instinct or tendency, not reasoning. Through its instincts, an animal is sensitive to certain objects or situations, sugar, light, heat, humidity. It seeks them or avoids them. A man has instincts, and moreover, he is sensitive to certain values that give him affective interest and that largely guide his actions, while leaving the choice of means, which depends on intermediate information, to his control. It often happens that the various instincts or interests do not match. The animal or man is then obliged to choose or adopt an average behavior that harmonizes the various interests. Instincts and interests are not pure thrusts a tergo. They compel the organism to go in a certain general direction, but the intermediate behavior is flexible and can be adapted to circumstances and obstacles. Moreover, the animal or man is capable not only of improvising intermediate behaviors according to his purpose, but of learning better ways to reach that purpose and of transferring the value of sign or of means from one intermediate object to another. Self-regulation, self-awareness, and the perception of interesting objects or situations, the balance and harmonization of interests, and even learning and transfer. All of these things, according to the cyberneticians, are common to both automatic machines and organisms.
Right. So this is like sort of the getting more to the specific idea of cybernetics, which is sort of focused on this feedback concept, or the way that a machine can be made to sort of regulate its own functioning. And of course, when Norbert Wiener presents this concept, and when a lot of the early cyberneticians present this concept, they take it that these self-regulating machines are finalistic in some sense, that they are that the functioning of these types of machines helps us understand the goal-directedness of animal and human behavior. Sort of the classic example is the thermostat, where like you set it to a certain temperature, and then if it detects that the temperature is below a certain value, whatever value you set it to, then it will turn on the furnace, and the furnace, you know, increases the temperature in the room until it reaches that value that you set it to, and then it turns off. So this very simple device has this sort of feedback process where the operation of the machine, you know, turning on the furnace, produces a kind of change in the system, the room furnace thermostat system, that brings about a change in the functioning of the machine, namely turning off the thermostat once turning off the furnace once the room reaches the temperature. And so this is like a sort of goal-directed behavior, or it's analogous to goal-directed behavior. You can imagine that you like had a person, you know, standing in the room and running back and forth between the room and the furnace, like, you know, seeing, is it warm or is it cold in the room, and I'm going to turn the furnace on or off depending on how it feels. The thermostat is like, you know, producing the same effect as this person who like has a goal of, you know, keeping the room at a certain temperature. And then likewise, you have like animals, for example, that again, you can use temperature as an example. You have like a lizard that lives in a desert environment that, will like, you know, overnight it gets cold, and its body temperature will cool down. And then when the sun comes up in the morning, it will like, you know, find itself, you know, move itself to sit on a rock or something to, you know, absorb, heat from the sun and the stone that heats up under the sunlight. And then its body temperature increases till it gets to the right temperature that it can, you know, move around and hunt or whatever it does. But then as the temperature continues to rise over the course of the day, it will find shade to keep itself from overheating. So this lizard is, you know, goal directed towards the goal of maintaining its body temperature in a certain range, not too hot, not too cold. And this is, you know, for a cybernetician, you can just explain this in terms of like a slightly more complicated feedback mechanism than the thermostat example, because here you're not just, turning on a furnace when the temperature gets too low, but you're like operating to keep the temperature within a certain range. You have different mechanisms for increasing or decreasing the temperature based on where the body temperature is situated in relation to the desired range. Of course, Rie is going to deny that this sort of feedback process is sufficient to explain goal-directed behavior in animals or human beings. Again, because this is like a purely mechanical process that, you know, the machine, the thermostat doesn't care what temperature you put it at. It doesn't know what the point of having a room at 22 degrees is compared to, you know, 100 degrees, depending on how wide the range of the thermostat is, like, you know, whatever temperature you set it to, it will just, you know, set the furnace to turn on to keep the temperature in at that level. The fact that a human might find the room hot or cold or whatever doesn't matter to the thermostat. It has no like grasp of why it should, you know, use a certain level, a certain temperature or a different one. Rie is again denying that you can like sort of reproduce the more sophisticated goal-directed behavior of you know, other animals and much less human beings just by like, you know, adding together and making like more complicated feedback loops and so on, which is sort of what the cybernetician had presupposed.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, 61. Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm thinking of like a simple tropism and taxism in plants and animals, or plants and very simple forms of life, like a bacterium that's making its way up a sugar gradient and moving towards higher sugar concentration. I think we talked about this a few times in the Simondon reading group. Like Simondon, for instance, rejects the cybernetic hope, I guess, that like the human being can be understood as a very complicated homeostat because of the ability for the human being to kind of give itself direction. But, you know, it's not meaningfully the case, I think, for the bacterium. I suppose it could choose not. Well, I don't know. It would be difficult to argue that that is the case for the bacterium. So then I guess the question for me is, what is the difference? If that Simondonian objection is not available, and I guess it would be something like, again, the idea of Sorval, or maybe what Merleau-Ponty would call the perceptual situation, The role of the perceptual situation and explaining even the physiology of the living being, which Merleau-Ponty went over in great detail in Structure of Behavior. But yeah, I don't know if that would be how exactly that aligns with Ruya.
Yeah, the bacterium example is an interesting one because there's been, like, over the last, I don't know, 10 or 20 years, like, a lot more research into the behavior of, you know, bacteria and other single-celled organisms that turns out to be a lot more sophisticated than had been previously thought. You have, like, bacteria that will swim up a concentration gradient, a sugar concentration gradient. It's not necessarily, obviously it depends on the specific, type of bacterium, but yeah, it's not necessarily this, like, mechanical process where that just sort of follows this gradient no matter what, because often they are sensitive to many different factors, like not just the sugar concentration gradient, but like possibly a magnetic field, the gradients of other chemicals and so on. And they have to, like, integrate the information coming in like all these different ways and, make a decision or something analogous to a decision, about, like, am I going to swim up the sugar gradient or down this, like, gradient of this other poisonous chemical? Those might conflict and it might have to, decide whether to follow the sugar or avoid the poison, for example. So it turns out, so there's a sort of field that's sometimes described as a basal cognition, bacteria are actually cognitive entities that they're, taking in information about the world and behaving in a way that responds to that information in a way that involves integrating different sources of information and evaluating them and so on, rather than just sort of mechanically following, going up a sugar gradient or whatever it is. This, I think, already, obviously bacteria are, like, quite simple organisms in certain respects. But it already shows that this, like, depiction of living beings as, like, homeostats in, like, the cybernetic sense is probably an oversimplification, even when you're just dealing with single-celled organisms.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm trying to think about, like, how to relate Brie to Merleau-Ponty. And it kind of seems, at least my initial impression, my initial understanding of this distinction between, like, these stepwise mechanical processes on the one hand and the kind of whole first melodic survival situations on the other is analogous to the phenomenological perceptual situation for Merleau-Ponty. I wonder if Ruye would endorse Merleau-Ponty's arguments about the kind of the incompleteness of the physiological explanation without accounting for the perceptual situation, in order to kind of complete the physiological picture, you need to consider something like this transcendental situation of the being. I don't know, kind of rambling a bit, but something that I'm going to, I guess, try to keep in mind as we keep reading to get a sense for how they might align or where they might diverge.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because Merleau-Ponty, as we saw, makes this distinction between, like, the vital level and the psychological or mental level, that these are sort of qualitatively distinct levels of understanding. Whereas it's not clear to me that Ruye also makes the same distinction, or it seems to me that he's, like, more willing to take these two types of sort of melodic or these two types of Sirvad as being largely the same. So he's sort of three levels where, like, you have this, like, very basic level of these simple organisms that will just have this sort of very straightforward response of, like, how the frog will try to grasp the insect even when it hits the, yeah, exactly, these poor frogs or toads or whatever it was, that you know, you have a piece of glass, and you have a frog in like an aquarium or something, and you put the insect or the worm outside the aquarium on the other side of the glass, and the frog will, you know, do its like tongue flicking thing to try to grasp this prey over and over again, even though it keeps hitting the glass. It never sort of learns, okay, I need to like get around this glass before I can actually reach my prey. So it's like, this is sort of like the reflex concept that was, you know, used in early 20th century physiology. It like sort of most applicable to this type of behavior. And then of course you have like a bit more sophisticated behavior in other organisms and probably frogs in other circumstances as well, where it's like, you know, working towards, say, reaching a prey animal, but if you sort of put a barrier or reaching a goal of some kind, if you put some sort of barrier between the animal and the prey, it will, you know, figure out a way to get around the barrier and go towards the prey after, you know, this detour. Or, you know, so you had like these maze navigation tasks, for example, the other example that Merleau-Ponty gave was these chickens that learn not to, you know, respond to a particular shade of gray as being the one that labels the good food source, but rather to select the lighter or the darker of two shades of gray, no matter which, you know, concrete shade is actually presented to them. So like, you can have one pair of shades of gray, A and B, and then and say A is the lighter and B is darker, and then you can have another pair, B and C, where C is even darker than B. But then if you present B and C, what was the dark shade is now the light shade, and the chicken will choose B, even though before that was the dark shade that it wouldn't choose. So it's learning not just, you know, this concrete shade of gray labels the good food source, but rather it learns the lighter shade of, when presented with two shades of gray, the lighter one is the one that labels the good food source. So it's learning like to recognize a difference of shades as opposed to just like this mechanical response to being presented with a single shade. And then of course, in the case of humans, we learn not just like, you know, these structures of, you know, lighter and darker and, you know, above and below and so on, but we also can operate in like symbolic terms where we have these representations of either objects or relations between objects or like structures and so on. We can grasp these symbols and make use of them in like a much more flexible way, that someone can, for example, write a word on the page. And this is actually an example that Lacan gives somewhere where he's like criticizing behaviorism, where he says like, you could train a rat to like blink whenever you play the word blink on a loudspeaker, for example. But if you like, if you say like, don't blink, if you like change the instruction to don't blink, the like association between the sound of the word blink and the blinking response will still happen in the rat. Whereas a human who understands the word blink and, you know, the structure of negation of a sentence and so on will, hear the new instruction, don't blink, and respond differently. So even obviously like this very simple, you know, negation of a command is something, is operating at a different level than just associating a certain sound and a certain response. And so this is like sort of a symbolic, it requires learning a symbolic pattern of, you know, what it means to negate a command, for example, which is, you know, very different than just sort of like associating one word with one object or one response or whatever. So this is sort of like a digression through Merleau-Ponty, but the point here is that this symbolic learning is something that he seems to take only humans to be capable of, and he talked about like, you know, these experiments with apes learning to, you know, manipulate boxes to reach a banana, for example, and how their capacity to learn how to manipulate these boxes seems to be relatively limited. Like they never sort of figure out that you have to stack up the boxes in a certain way so that they are like balanced and won't just fall down. They just sort of stack them up haphazardly and, you know, climb them as fast as possible to reach the banana before the whole thing collapses, rather than like where the human in this situation would obviously like try to stack the boxes in a way that they actually like stay up and don't collapse immediately. So the ape doesn't have any like sort of grasp of like the general principles of like what it is that makes a certain structure stable or not. And yeah, so for Merleau-Ponty, there's like this qualitative difference between humans' sort of capacity to learn these symbolic structures, whereas the ape can only learn these like what he calls these syncretic structures, like, you know, can sort of come to see the boxes as potentially climbable, but can't sort of grasp like sort of geometrical principles of like stacking boxes together. And whereas Rieh seems to identify not even just animal behavior, but even the development of organisms, you know, towards the adult form as basically the same kind of thing as human learning, including of this like symbolic kind. Okay, so we're about at the 2 hour mark. So I suggest we stop here. Was any like final comments? Cool. Okay, so yeah, thanks everyone. And yeah, we'll pick up again on this next week.